When I was named Teacher of the Year, Dr. Witherspoon was in the board, were just extremely supportive. And at the time, we had to decide what my duties were going to be this year. And I, of course, said, if you would like to give me a full course load, I'm happy to take it. But I will be saying no to non-essential duties. And I will be saying no to speaking engagements that aren't of the utmost importance and necessary. And I think that Dr. Witherspoon understood that having a Teacher of the Year was really an opportunity for the district to be able to showcase that we have highly competent and highly effective teachers. And he gave me a temporary assignment to the Department of Professional Development. And so every day here, you know, it changes every day what I do. So this week, for example, on Monday, I was at a luncheon celebrating teachers and was one of the speakers at the luncheon. Wednesday, I did an all-day session with mathematics teachers. In the morning, I worked with Algebra 1 teachers in the district, and in the afternoon, I worked with Algebra 2 teachers in the district. And then Thursday and Friday this week, I've been at this conference on Learning Forward, which is a professional development opportunity for teachers. So this is one of the few cases I haven't been a speaker, but I've just been able to add more tools to my own kit. And so if I'm not traveling and I'm not doing professional development for the teachers within our district, then I still go to Jackson Olin, and I have been working with some of the new teachers at Jackson Olin, as well as co-teaching AP statistics, because that's really my love, and I had recruited a lot of those students. And we had a wonderful opportunity this year. We, a teacher that had been doing AP calculus and AP statistics at Ramsey actually came to Jackson Olin and is doing AP calculus and AP statistics there. And it's a great opportunity for our students. And so it's not really missing a beat to miss me for the year. So I still try to go as much as possible.
I know it's going to be hard to boil down, but tell me a little bit about how you got to be at this point Teacher of the Year. Obviously, you're a good teacher. You've been recognized as such. Tell me about your background, how you ended up in the field.
I really ended up in the field almost, I guess, accidentally. I never really saw teaching as a profession. I grew up, both my parents were doctors, and I just really ended up in this opportunity where I had this talent at a very young age of breaking down mathematics for other students to understand. And so in high school, people's parents were hiring me to come tutor my peers, both my same age and older and younger, and it was kind of like a side job for me in high school. And I went off to college, and I had a double major in mathematics and English. And when I came home my senior year, it was graduated, and I had no idea what I was going to do. And my father took me out to lunch, and he said, "What are you going to do?" And I was like, "Well, there's a part of me that wants to go get an MBA and enter in the world of finance. And I think I would really love it and get into the hustle and bustle of it all. And I see myself being successful there. And there's another part of me that really just knows I have a talent for teaching and has thought about being a teacher, but I just don't know. I don't know if I could be a teacher." And I really was concerned that, and this is very shallow, but concerned that there was just a lack of prestige in the field, and was concerned that nobody would look at me as having a real job, and that people would perceive me as being a failure almost. Because I think that's where we've really put teachers these days. And it's sad. It's a sad state that we're in. Because really, as you hear people talk, politicians and reform effort and business and industry, they all want to make it sound like teachers are the problem, and that's not really the problem. And my father said to me at that lunch, he said, "My biggest hope for you is that you feel as if you get paid to play." He said, "I love what I do, and every day I go into work, I enjoy working. I enjoy my job." And he said, I can only hope that much for you as my daughter. Everything else will follow." And that right then, I said, "Well, Dad, I want to be a teacher." And he said, well, okay, then, you know, you're going to do your master's here in Birmingham, because it's not necessarily that important where the master's comes from. And you can do your master's at UAB, which was a wonderful experience. And I said, but Dad, I think I want to be in the inner city. And he asked why, of course. And I just really felt like I wanted to be at a place where I knew that I'd be needed. Not necessarily appreciated, but needed. And that was a decision I made in 97. And I started teaching at Inslee High School in 1999. And, of course, we closed and merged with Jackson Olin. And I have been in that Inslee Pratt City community for 15 years now. So that has really become my second home.
You said that teachers are not the problem. So, I mean, I know this is another huge question, but what is the problem?
I think we have a multitude of problems at this point. I think that, first of all, people have made the Common Core and or college and career ready standards a political issue, and it's not a political issue. It really started and was developed at a national level by teachers and curriculum specialists. And the basic idea was, you know, if good learning and good teaching is good learning and good teaching, shouldn't it be good learning and good teaching everywhere? And especially people in military families where students bounced around. Whether I'm in Michigan or Alabama, I should virtually be experiencing the same thing in third grade. And so teachers came together and developed standards at national. Now there's a difference between national and federal. And that's a very fine line in some people's head, and they don't really differentiate the two. But there's really clearly a difference. So this was just a collaboration effort. And then Alabama said, okay, bring them. Let's look at what happened. And so we took our existing standards, and then we took the Common Core standards, and we compared them. And we made things like, well, maybe if we move this to here and this to there, that would be good. And we decided we liked the Common Core, but then we decided there were certain standards that we liked as our own, so we kept them. In this process, we developed the standards for the state of Alabama, and they're not exactly the same as the standards for Massachusetts. And the best way I can explain it to people is there's two ways. First of all, in mathematics, we had conversations such as, where should we teach matrices? Where should we teach conic sections? Are they placed in the most appropriate place right now? Should we move them? And then we had conversations of, it's really important that students be able to interpret data. Let's integrate statistics at different levels now. Let's have students learn to analyze data and make sense of real life data. And then at a lower grade, we might say, okay, well, 9 times 8 is 72, and that's important. But shouldn't a child be able to say, if I need to carpet a room that's 9 feet by 8 feet, how much carpet should I buy? So this is kind of the shift we're looking at. And this is pretty much what we're talking about. And in terms of English language arts, we're saying, you know, when a child goes into a profession, a boss is going to hand them a procedure book that might talk about new banking standards and new federal regulations. That might not be considered, quote, fun reading. So we said, you know, really in the real world, students need to be able to interact with informational text. Therefore, we need to increase the amount of informational text that we're giving students so that we're better preparing students to analyze information in the real world. So we adopted these standards, which have now become this hotbed for politics. Like so much else in education. Because it's a multi-billion dollar industry and everyone wants a piece of a multi-billion dollar industry. And that's just the bottom line that nobody wants to talk about. So we created these new standards, which are just great. And they really should be an opportunity to free teachers to go back to teaching. But what has happened is, under old legislation of No Child Left Behind and high-stakes testing, and that's on its way out with the standards kind of new standards kind of coming in, there's this whole kind of confusion about how we're going to assess the new standards. And so we're trying to use, kind of place an old model on new standards, and some, you know, companies have come out with like scripted materials that really, instead of unleashing teachers to be free, we're kind of trying to lock them into curriculum. But there's a difference between standards and curriculum. Curriculum is adopted at the local level. And so the best way I can explain standards to people is, I stole this from Huckabee actually, is that if you are on a basketball court, that if you're playing for the NBA, you know that every single court is going to be the same. The basketball rim is going to be at the same height, and the court has the same length and has the same width. This is your standards. Your coach is still the teacher in the classroom. She is getting to decide, or he is getting to decide, exactly how that game is played. So every NBA team plays a little bit differently because their coach is different. The standards are the court and the rim. The curriculum is the coach, and the curriculum is still developed at the local level. And so people are talking about the fact that the Common Core State Standards are a federal curriculum, but it is a national set of standards, and the curriculum is still local level. So that's the basic idea. So what's problematic at this point is, A, we're trying to integrate and implement the standards underneath old testing models, even though that's not even necessarily what the state's saying to do, but there's kind of just a whole bunch of growing pains at this point. The standards are good, and teachers like the standards, and teachers support the standards. I will say teachers are a bit fearful of how legislators are going to want to assess the standards and try to hold teachers accountable to a single test score, which has numerous problems in education. And I think part of this comes down to business and industry. If I own a plastic company, I put a piece of plastic in a machine, and it goes through the machine, and it comes out of as a lid, and if it is 0.0001 centimeters within the margin of error, within my goal, then I am successful. And they say this is measurable. So therefore, everything is measurable. So we want to measure everything with a single test score and base that test score on where we think some sort of norming should be. And that's not really indicative of learning. And it doesn't really take in the complex concepts that teachers try to work with every day. And it doesn't take in the complexity of context, because if a child comes to school hungry, the test score is not necessarily their main focus that day. And so there's a whole level of complexities that come within just issues that are related to environment. And so teachers are fighting a lot of different struggles. And I think it gets very stressful when you say, well, little Johnny's test score determines whether you're effective or not. Well, have we tracked little Johnny to see how little Johnny's grown over time? You know, under the old system with the graduation exam, students would need a 477 to pass mathematics. And there were situations where a student and I worked all year and raised that score from a 0 to a 375. And under the old system, they wanted me to tell that student that he or she was a failure. And see, I couldn't do that. So I would go to the student and say, look at this data. Look how far you've come. You're so close. Look what you've done. If we continue at this pace, you're going to pass and you're going to be successful and this is going to be great and you're going to get that diploma. And then I would go behind closed doors and take my spanking for being a failing teacher. But I would never tell the child, because I had to explain to that child that there are still possibilities. And then they would pass that next year and we would celebrate, and I would celebrate with that child, even though that data never counted for me again because they didn't pass their junior year. And so, you know, there's a lot of things students didn't understand about how teachers were being ranked according to that, but good teachers never really told the students that because they were more focused on student learning. So we really have to ask, how are we going to measure teacher effectiveness, and is it fair to do it by a single test score? And if we're going to do it by a single test score, are we measuring growth, or are we comparing it to some arbitrary norm out there that we think all students should reach at the same time? And so basically, you know, there's this idea that all kids should be at the same place at the same time, and any parent will tell you that their two children are completely different and have their own unique personalities. Well, now you have a room of 30 kids that are completely different with their own unique personalities. And so there's an art and science to teaching that's not necessarily respected.
Speaking of which, you mentioned before that when you were sort of at a crossroads as far as your career, it worried you that teaching was not held in the highest regard. I mean, do you think that is ultimately at the root of sort of all these big picture problems?
I don't know if it's the root of all the big picture problems, but I think that the perception of what teachers do, you know, even people jokingly will say, well, you have your summers off. I haven't had a summer off in 15 years. I don't know what a summer off looks like. And so if that's still society's idea of what it means to be a teacher, then we have some problems, because teachers spend their Junes and July in meeting, after learning opportunity, after planning opportunity, and are looking already at the data of the students that are coming into their class for the next year, and looking at interviews maybe with students and CUM records or different pieces of information that are going to help them plan. And teachers, you know, I spend time in conferences where I'm trying to learn exactly how to better teach a topic. And then I spend time in data meetings. And then I spend time in school planning meetings. And then, you know, someone's begging me, can we please take a vacation? And trying to fit a vacation into the summer can be complicated with all the different things you're trying to do to prepare for, wrap up one school year and prepare for the next.
Well, speaking of complexity and perception, so what's it like? You know, you teach at Jackson Olin. You've taught there for how long, did you say?
Well, I've been in that community for 15 years I was at Inslee High School and Jackson Olin.
Right. Okay. So you've been there for quite a while. And like other schools in the Birmingham district, it's basically all black. What is that like for you as a white teacher?
You know, it's interesting because I guess I've kind of assimilated so much into the environment that when I think of my school, I don't even necessarily think of it as an all-black school. I see my students as black students because I see them as who they are. I think sometimes I lose my own identity more than not accepting the identity of who my students are. It's not like when I'm in my classroom, I'm realizing that I'm even different. But I mean, I think that has just become part of growing in the community. That's really become a home for me. Now, granted, if you picked me up and moved me to another school, it would be a shock for me to even move within another school in my district, because to me, the schools are so unique based on the communities they serve.
What's unique about Jackson Olin?
I think there's a rich history at Jackson Olin. We have a history from even being Western Olin, and an alumni association that's proud of their school. And so, you know, even at the J.O. Parker football game, it's a deal. It's a big deal, you know, especially the two historically African-American high schools playing each other. And so there's a big alumni buy-in and support. We are known for the mighty Mustang Band, the marching band, and there's a history in that, and there's an importance in that, and understanding that, and being able to engage in the dances and the pep rally and the parades, and there's just a spirit of community there. And I think that other schools have their own identity, and I think that's important to understand and bring in the history of that school.
Do you think that, and this may or may not be a racial question, you can answer it any way you like, of course, do you think that the media coverage of the Birmingham school system in the last, say, 2 years, since, you know, all the sort of quote-unquote dysfunction on the board. Do you think the media coverage of the Birmingham School District has been fair or accurate or comprehensive or none of the above? What do you think about it?
I laugh. I remember reading a news article after I was first named Teacher of the Year that said, Grizzle slammed media.
I didn't see that, by the way.
Well, okay. And I found it funny because, you know, at the time I did, and I said, you know, at the time when I was in the finals, a news reporter showed up, and I had a student say, what's wrong? Was there a gun in the school? Why are they here? Was there a big fight that I don't know about? I said, no, they're here to tape us and tape our class and what we're doing. Why? Are we in trouble? And it just hit me with, that's really problematic. It's problematic that students think when there's media, there's something wrong. And so I thought about it and I said, you know, that's because that's when they come. They come when there's problems because there's not good news. There's not that good news doesn't sell papers. High drama sells papers. We live in a world of reality TV where we think the Bad Girl Fight Club, for some reason, is high quality. And we think that the housewives of wherever is exciting while they're sitting there cursing each other out, and somehow that's good media, right? And so we think that sells papers. The sensationalism of it all sells papers. And so I found it disturbing that my students think that's when media comes. And so I shared that. And I shared that when I won, a student had come to me. It was a day or two before I won, and she said, I saw you on the news. And I said, you did? Did I look cute? She said, well, I saw you and it was great. And I said, well, why was it great? And she said, because it was so good to hear them sharing something nice about our school. And I said, you know, that's a good point. And I'm glad they were here to share something nice. And I've shared that, and there are great things going on in a bunch of the Birmingham City schools. And we still have a long way to go. I am not blind to the fact that there are still achievement gaps. And there are still gaps between lower socioeconomic students and middle-class students. And there's gaps between black students and there's gaps between white students. And that's a problem. And, you know, I think that this year, too, there was a news article about an altercation at Jackson Olin that some students had gotten in, and so they ran. And, you know, one of the quotes in the article said there was blood everywhere that was taken from a child that was sensationalizing something that wasn't even true, but it sounded good in the paper. And so we need to say, you know what, is it really that exciting that some students got to fighting over neighborhood issues? Is that really that exciting? Or should I be talking about some of the innovative programs? Should I be talking about the culinary arts program that served breakfast to Leadership Birmingham? Should I talk about how Leadership Birmingham visited the classrooms and sat down and had conversations with our students? Is that the conversation I should be having instead of there was an altercation?
Do you think the state takeover was necessary, warranted?
You know, that's hard to talk about because I don't feel like I'm properly armed enough with the facts. I can tell you that I think this new board is kind of exciting. I feel like, and this is Allison talking, this is not, you know, I feel like the public said, Dr. Witherspoon, we believe in you. And we are untying your hands. And we are unleashing you. And please, do whatever you think is necessary
to move this school system forward. And that's what I heard in the election of the new board. And when they nominated Randall Woodfin as president, I thought, you know, we might be going somewhere. And some people say, well, he's a first-year board member. He is. But he's an, you know, he's a lawyer in town. He has a passion for students, but he has a passion for teachers. And I've liked what I've seen. You know, 2 weeks from now, I might be sitting here singing a different story, but so far, I feel like majority of the board is saying, let's stop some of the foolishness and let's do what's right by children and let's make some changes and let's not get involved in things that we don't need to be involved in.
So cautious optimism, is that about right?
I don't necessarily even think it's that cautious. I have a great hope for where we are.
Are there some concrete things that make give you optimism, you know, thinking this is going to work, this is already paying dividends, or anything in the very near future that make you excited and optimistic about the Birmingham school system?
I'm cautiously, well, let's see. I like some of the things that I see going on in Woodlawn. I like some of the initiatives with the Woodlawn Innovative Network. And the Woodlawn Foundation is working in A+, College Ready is working, and all of these people are kind of working to transform the way we think about education and considering implementing the stuff as wraparound services and students actually gaining college credit in high school with dual enrollment. And I think that's exciting. I think that some of the career academies have great promise. I see internships that students are doing with some really pretty high-level careers being exciting. You know, I got a list recently on an email of some students that were going to, one was going to be working in the ER, and one was working with a radiologist. And there was like a list of like these medical careers, and that's exciting. You know, students thinking about what they're going to do in the future is exciting. And I think the career academies have a lot of promise. I think Dr. Witherspoon, I like the strategic plan. There's some really measurable things in the plan. I think that J.W. Carpenter being named to director of Birmingham Education Foundation is a positive step. I think that he and I have had conversations, and he's looking at what's missing. And he's looking at it from perspective of what do teachers need to be successful? How can I help teachers? And so he has me in charge of doing some different focus groups with teachers so he can hear from the teachers. And I think that's important. You know, it's been so interesting this year serving as Alabama Teacher of the Year. I've been invited to a lot of different meetings. And I walk in, and it's been touted as a educational reform meeting. So I walk in and I'll look around and I'll be like, where are the teachers? And they're like, we don't have any. Where are the administrators? Well, there aren't any. Oh, so wait a minute. You have a group of businessmen and women sitting around talking about how you're going to reform education, and you're not asking the teachers about what makes sense and reforming a career you know nothing about. You know, and what I've learned is anybody that has attended K-12 education thinks that he or she has the solution for K-12 education. If you have graduated from high school, you think you know how to fix high school. That's a bit of a problem. I don't walk into my doctor's office and tell her, here's how I want you to treat me. I don't walk into a surgeon and say, this is what I think you need to do in surgery, because I'm not a surgeon. I'm not going to walk into Alabama Power and tell them how to run Alabama Power, because I don't know anything about how Alabama Power runs. But I have electricity in my house,
And under that model, because I have electricity in my house, I should be able to be the president of Alabama Power. And that's a completely ridiculous idea. And if I told anybody I have a gas furnace, please name me the president of Energen, they would say, well, that's a ridiculous connection. Well, that's about as ridiculous as you attended high school, so you know how to fix it.
If you had to tell our listeners one thing right now, is there anything that I missed, anything that you think our listeners should know?
I would tell your listeners to go to their local school. Call ahead. Tell the principal you'd like to visit. You'd like to see what's going on. And go in a school. Look at the great teaching going on in the state of Alabama. I spent yesterday at Calera High School and was blown away. Those students are making artificial limbs and taking them to Honduras and being there to help transform a community. Those students are building from the ground up small little four-wheel, it's almost like a golf cart that goes off of off-road. I don't even know how to talk about what it is, and these students are building it from the floor up with conversations such as, well, I just drew it, and then we did this, and they've made a hydroelectric power plant to take to Honduras out of a pontoon boat and a turbine wheel. That's amazing. But if you don't go to your local school and ask, what are you doing? Then you don't know what education looks like today. And until you go into a local school, and until you talk to students, and until you talk to teachers, please do not try to draw conclusions about something without all the facts.
Just remind me, there's one thing I wanted to ask you about. When I was teaching, let's just say two of the years that I was teaching, there was a principal who was less than stellar. And one thing that she used to do, this is a real thing, but it's also sort of a metaphor. She would see one kid sort of walking where the kid wasn't supposed to be outside of the main office, and she would get on the intercom and yell at the entire school during teaching time. What we ended up doing, we actually wrapped winter coats around the intercom to kind of muffle it and try to sort of drown it out. Is that what sort of an equivalent of what good teachers do or did when all this craziness about the Birmingham School Board was erupting and it was all over the media, local, regional, and national media? I mean, do good teachers just put their heads down and work no matter what's going on, or did it really affect your colleagues and your students as far as morale?
Good teachers persevere. But as legislators fight over college and career ready standards, as board members fight, and as people publicly blame teachers, and as people talk constantly about failing schools, failing teachers, and failing students, even good teachers get tired. And there's a power behind negative perceptions that beats good teachers down. I have spent 15 years in a community where they try to tell the students that the school is a failing school. And if I'm a student in poverty, and I constantly hear that I'm going to a school that's failing with teachers that are failing, then I don't see much hope. But that's not the reality. And this whole idea sometimes of labeling schools as as failing is problematic for multiple reasons, especially sometimes how it's assessed. And I could spend hours on that, which obviously you don't have. But good teachers persevere, but society needs to understand that even good teachers get tired of hearing that they're not good. And that's one reason for me that being named Alabama Teacher of the Year was so important, because it wasn't about me. It was about the teachers in my district who persevere and continue to work and continue to do and continue to show up every day and give it their all and are trying to transform the lives of students. It was an accolade to them that said, we recognize that there are some great teachers in Birmingham City Schools.